My name is Mel Peel, and the session this evening is called Varieties of Religious Politics. And I'm going to spend some time this evening talking about different kinds and forms of religiously motivated political action. Primarily, I'm orienting my discussion around the United States, but I think this issue, this concern, could also be applied to many other kinds of situations and societies as well. Let me start off by defining what I mean by religious political action or religious politics, and perhaps distinguish. Can you folks see this at all? Mm-hmm. Perhaps distinguishing it from a couple of other things that are somewhat related, but that I would want to make a difference from religious politics. One would be to distinguish it from religious social action per se. That is, religious politics is religiously motivated action designed to shape the polity. That is, the public authoritative laws or values or institutions of the state. Okay? So religiously motivated action that attempts to affect or alter or shape the fundamental political values, institutions, or laws of a given society is what I'm talking about. Religious social action would be action operating directly on society or social arrangements, but not attempting to alter the fundamental political laws or institutions or values. So, for example, if a church or a church body would say, open a halfway house for prisoners, let's say. That would be religious social action, right? But that would be different from a religiously motivated action attempting to alter political, which I define as authoritative public policy. Policies that define what are the rules in the whole given territory of a given society or state, in this case the United States. And I would also want to distinguish this from religiously motivated political action within a given religious community itself. That is, people might engage in politically motivated action to alter the forms of their own community in some way, and that could involve some political elements, but that's not directed at the whole society at large. You could have all kinds of political values and arrangements set up within a given community, but it would not necessarily be directed outward. So you can see that by my definitions and assumptions, I'm dealing here primarily with a pluralistic kind of environment in which religious values or communities or people are not the only thing that exists in a given polity, or at least there's a very great diversity. The common word we use for this in the United States is pluralism, right? There's a great variety of values, institutions, people that exist within the polity, some of them coming out of different religious traditions, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Mormon, whatever else you might have, a tremendous stew of people, and obviously non-religious within a given polity. So religious political action is designed, religiously motivated action, designed to affect the whole state. Okay, well, I'm going to move through then some different types and models of that kind of religiously motivated political action, and describe a little bit about what each of these models might do or could do or has done in different kinds and ways and contexts, and then hopefully have this open for some discussion, particularly about the dilemma, at least that I see, in almost any kind of religiously motivated political action, at least from a Christian perspective, or at least from some Christian perspectives. Well, the first kind I call political witness. That is the idea that you will affect the public values of the state primarily by modeling or witnessing to certain politically held values that you share on the basis of your religion. Okay? Now, in a way, this is almost not quite politics yet, because it really does not attempt to itself enter the arena of power or politics. In a way, it stands aloof from the arena of power or politics, but it fits under my definition because it's people saying, in effect, look how we run our polity. Why doesn't the larger society operate its polity the same way? And to the extent that that's directed outward and is not simply an inwardly directed religious ideal, then I think it fits my definition of religious politics. And this kind of thing could be either communal, that is, a group establishing its own particular kind of political model and saying, see how we do it here, why don't you all follow this kind of arrangement? Or it could be simply personal, that is, someone walking out on Fifth Avenue in New York and holding a sign saying, stop all nukes. Okay? That, by my definition, is a kind of political witness. It's not attempting to alter the power structure, but it is attempting to witness to certain political values motivated by religion, but not itself attempting to act on the structures or institutions of power. So, in a sense, this model defends heavily on persuasion rather than direct political action. That is, the only impact it can have is if, in fact, other people look over and say, oh yeah, I see, that's the way to do it, the way you do it, rather than the way we do it. That's a different way to, say, run our foreign policy or arrange our domestic institutions or whatever. Second kind is one that has really had relatively little impact in the United States after the colonial period, but I think it's important to mention as a model, and that is what I would call the Christian-dominated polity. That is, this would be the idea that the task is to arrange the political order of society on essentially Christian principles or with Christian values dominating the state. Okay? Historically, that's the kind of model, at least ostensibly, that existed in the whole Constantinian era of Europe up to the time of the French Revolution. That is, the states, the governments, were officially Christian, and their policies, ostensibly at least, were designed to promote Christian values. Now, how that was defined and how that worked out, you might have plenty of questions about, and I certainly would too, but it obviously makes a considerable difference if you say we have now organized our state on Christian principles and we are going to make our policies on the basis of Christianity, however that turns out to be interpreted. And from now on, for example, we will say that certain things not permitted in the Gospels will not be permitted in the society. That will be the law of the state, let's say, for example. That would be an extreme kind of thing. The sort of thing, the classical models, of course, are the Catholic powers of late medieval and early modern Europe, and then Calvin's Geneva. John Calvin in Geneva really attempted to reorganize the entire society on Christian models. Again, how that defined was rather interesting, but all the laws, all the structures, all the policies, all the bankers, all the marriages, everything organized according to John Calvin's understanding of what Christianity implied for everybody in society, including those who he knew, of course, did not share Christian belief, but you had to, in the public law, follow the Christian model. You have a similar kind of thing in some of the Christian democratic parties of Europe and Latin America, and some other kinds of models that you could find as well. But what this would mean, essentially, to bring this model a little closer to home and to envision it in the United States, which I don't expect to happen very soon, would be, let's suppose that the people of Holden Village would suddenly, by some amazing miracle, the crowd right here would suddenly have the total power to reshape American society, government, institution, foreign policy, defense policy, and so on. So this crowd right here would now have the rule over the United States. What kind of laws would you make? What kind of political institutions would you establish that would reflect your Christian understanding of the world, society, government, and so on? Or would you do that? I don't know. An interesting question. But that's the kind of thing you would have here, let us say. Okay. The third model is one, as I said, this second model has very little practical history in the United States, although here and there, people have talked about a Christian America or forming America along Christian lines or whatever. The third model is really the far more common one in this country and has had far more success, really. It's really the model that probably most people operate on when they think about religious political action, and that's what I call moral political movements. That is, movements designed to alter public policy arising from religious motives, usually focused around particular issues or particular kinds of issues, and designed to alter public policy on that particular issue, and so attempting to steer the national polity toward a desired goal by affecting the given institutions of government, political parties, so on and so on. The great examples of this, and let me rattle off four or five, the great examples of this that you would find would be things like abolitionism before the Civil War. That's really the great prototypical, where religious people rose up and demanded an end to slavery as a policy in the United States. Then you have things like prohibition, civil rights, obviously, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and more recently you could perhaps include things like anti-abortion movement or anti-nuclear movement or any number of others. Now one thing I could mention about these is, to the extent these enter the public arena in various ways, they may draw on alliances with other groups that do not share the same motives. And that's right away you have an interesting question there. That is, if you're working against nuclear war or you're working for civil rights, do you accept alliances from people who do not share your religious motives or values, but who agree with you on that particular question? That becomes an immediate issue in any religiously motivated political movement. And again, I would say this could operate on all kinds of levels, both propaganda, but all the way down to direct action, street action, sit-ins. Civil rights movement is the classic. Abolitionism is another classic. The anti-Vietnam War movement, others as well. This could be all the way from people writing letters to people marching in the streets, to people sitting in the streets, to people blocking draft board offices. Any policy action designed to alter, any religiously motivated action designed to alter the policies of the state. My fourth category is what I call official church action. This kind of movement, as I mentioned, does not really depend upon an entire religious community acting coherently. But there has also grown up in the United States very strong form of what I would call religiously motivated political action that derives from the official institutional churches acting in their public capacity, primarily through the means of social or political statements and official lobbying, primarily in Washington, but to some extent also in states as well. And you're all, I think, or many people are familiar with this process. The different churches, through their internal structures, work out a position on issue X. And then they have agencies or clerical offices that go before relevant political bodies and say, this is the official position of the Southern Baptist Convention on the question of religious education in public schools. Traditionally, the Southern Baptist Convention, surprisingly, always opposed that until very recently. And so every time the issue of prayer in public schools comes up, you can count on a good Southern Baptist to show up and say, we don't want it. Or nuclear war, or hunger questions, or whatever. All the major American denominations now have this kind of process. And it has developed very much over time. The first one apparently was 1916, the Methodist Church, established. They bought a nice building in Washington and set up the very first one of these, and they were followed, I have the dates here, the Quakers in 1943, primarily lobbying on the issue of how the treatment of conscientious objectors, but then carrying over into many other things. Many of these started as sort of single issue concerns, but then expanded more broadly. The Presbyterians and the Baptists showed up in 1949. The Baptist official who arrived said that their primary purpose initially was to keep an eye on the Catholics. Make sure they didn't get too much power. But again, since subsequently they expanded. The first Lutheran office in Washington was 1948. The National Council of Churches began its lobbying operation in 1950. And now apparently there are dozens of these representing almost every major church body, and some of them very sophisticated operations. Obviously the largest and most influential is the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, and their agency in Washington is called the United States Catholic Conference. And when people from the United States Catholic Conference walk up before a congressional committee, you know, the ears perk up. They are speaking on behalf of the whole church, ostensibly. However, there are some things about this process. Of course, in one sense, it seems very potent, right? Because these statements will always read, the Lutheran Church says X, Y, or Z. But what does that really mean? How does that really work in relation to the political process? There are a couple of problems that develop with that. One is, for particularly, that these offices are ostensibly non-political. That is, they do not directly attempt to shape or alter the political structures. They simply are operating as nonprofit agencies expressing their views on various proposals before the government. And they have to walk a very fine line. They can certainly, you know, make all the testimony they want or whatever, but they can't go out and start twisting arms and saying, you know, Congressman Jones, unless you do thus and such on the nuclear question, you're dead next term. They can't do that or they would lose their tax exemption. Now, maybe they should lose their tax exemption, but in practice, it doesn't work that way. The other difficulty is that as this process has developed over time, many people have asked, well, who do these people really represent? Where do these policies come from? These develop within these church agencies and denominations, but those are usually certain kinds of people who operate in those church structures. And what does that really mean in terms of any kind of real political influence? And many of the polls and things show that most of the people in the pews who belong to the church bodies don't agree with what their church people, their official church representatives are doing in Washington. So you have, and this developed particularly in relation to things like civil rights and Vietnam and the nuclear movement and so on. All the polls show that most of the pastors and the church officials and government bureaucrats, church bureaucrats, agree, for example, let's say, have an immediate nuclear freeze. But if you take a poll of Roman Catholics in the United States, they overwhelmingly disagree with that. So politicians are very quick to pick that up. They know that when that church statement comes out, where are the bodies to back that up? Okay. So that model, though, I think is a very important and influential one. A fifth model that I would mention I call the BFW model. And this is named after a very particular Christian political movement, Bread for the World, that some of you may have heard of. It seems to me, and again, this is a somewhat personal judgment here, that Bread for the World, which is defines itself as a Christian citizens lobby, represents a rather new and rather different kind of model of how to engage in Christian political action in the United States. What this group is essentially a group of Christians who have joined together on the hunger question, on the food question, and develop themselves into an organized movement or lobby that attempts to shape public policy on questions of food, hunger, grain distribution, all policies that relate to that particular sort of question. And over time, I don't know when the exact date, this began in the 1970s sometime, but over time they've developed a very sophisticated lobbying operation in Washington. They put out newsletters that deal with all this kind of issue. And what's most important is that they maintain organizations of people completely unofficial in many of the churches and local communities. And they have all kinds of procedures so that when a bill or a policy comes up, let's say something about we're about to cut funds for child nutrition programs in the United States, they'll immediately jump into action, call up their people out in the congressional district, and will say, we know that Senator Dole holds the key on this. All those people out in Kansas, hop on the phone or write your letter, call Senator Dole, get on his tail, make sure that he follows what we want on that particular kind of question. And I would like to mention, it seems to me, a couple of things that Bread for the World has done, which most Christian political action does not do, and something that gives it political influence of a sort that few religious political movements do, is the quality of its research and knowledge. That is, they have lots of people who really know how this issue works in terms of public policy and spend a lot of time researching it in those terms. What are the implications if we move $100 million from this budget to that budget and work that all out in great detail? I think it's fair to say that a great deal of religious political action is very strong on its feeling component, but not very strong in terms of its knowledge component. And one of the things that I think is rather interesting about Bread for the World is that they really know what they're talking about. They don't make a move in Washington or anywhere else without having the issue down cold. Now, obviously not every member can follow every detailed issue. It would be impossible. And frankly, when I get some of those thick letters that have about 40 pages, I mean, I can't work my way through it either. But you know that underlying, if they say this is an important question to take a stand on, that should be, it's got some kind of backing. And as I mentioned, the other thing they've done is organize nationally in terms of affecting the political process in that way, so that over time you develop a sort of constituency or relationship that operates not just from the top down, like an official church statement, but also in a sense from the ground up in affecting the political process in Washington. And the result of that, it seems to me, which again I think few religious political movements have, is that they have real clout, to borrow a term from Mayor Daley in Washington. People know where they're going on a given issue, and they play real politics in Washington. That means they know when this budget's coming up and they'll switch $100 million on this issue to that one. They're able to trade off, we'll take this on this budget, but will you guarantee us that next fall? And the kind of things, the way the real political process works, which again, a lot of religious politics, I'm generalizing obviously, but a lot does not. There are some other groups that follow this similar kind of model, I think. I think there's one called Impact and Network, which grew out of Catholic, primarily Catholic sisters or other kinds of movements of that sort that operate somewhat similarly without, I think, quite as many foot soldiers out in the hinterlands to support their positions. Well, the last model that I'll mention here is what I would call politicized religious communities. That is, this would be the effort or the attempt or the model of organizing the religious community itself around certain kinds of public or political goals and making people see all their public action and behavior in terms of its religiously motivated political impact. That is, where you would come to understand that all your political action, however that might be defined, in terms of your local community or your state or government or whatever, would be based upon religion, but the religion itself would have a kind of thrust towards saying, we want to alter the political situation. And the best model that you have of that, it seems to me, is the Black Church, where at least in past generations, great sectors of the Black Church, one of the essential religious convictions and the motivations, religious motivations that have been given to Black folks in the pews is the struggle for justice in the society at large. So that you come to understand your very religious function in part in terms of its impact upon the broader public policy process. And that helps explain why, for example, it's considered completely kosher to mix my communities, it's considered completely kosher to bring in politicians into the Black Church and say, well, you know, where are you on this bill? Where are you? And people, you know, from the pews will say, well, where do you stand on this? And then the community, as a religious community, says, you know, John Brown is battling for us on this question. We'll all vote for him. On the whole, most white Protestant communities have not operated that way. And in fact, most of them, there would be considerable shock if this kind of thing started happening. If people started coming in and saying, okay, what position are we going to take on this current defense bill? If that happened from the front of the church, and you know, we raised hands at the end and said, all right, that's the position of Bethlehem Lutheran Church on X. We're going to all go out and vote for candidates who support this position on the defense question. Most people don't think of their religious action in that kind of fashion. Roman Catholicism has had something comparable, although perhaps not as strong. But there are instances in which the community is religiously mobilized for a political goal at various times. And probably the dominant example of this in recent times has been the abortion question. That is where the religious motive is understood to be aimed at shaping a particular kind of public policy, and at least in some statements it has appeared to imply that it is an element of being a good Catholic is to look at candidates on the basis of their stands on the abortion question. And there have been several other similar instances, actually, in times in the past, and certain recent ones dealing, for example, to some extent, with the nuclear question. Okay, well, that's the end of my coverage of these different models, and perhaps you could think of others, and I don't want to maintain that these are absolutely pure types or whatever, But I think if you think about this a little while, and I hope we can have some discussion on this, the interesting question, the troublesome question that all this raises, I think, for religious people, and I'm speaking here primarily of Christians. I think these things might operate rather differently for Mormons or perhaps for Jews or perhaps for Buddhists or other kinds of religious communities. So I'm speaking here primarily of Christian communities. The troublesome question that's raised by this is, how does religious politics fit with a Christian vision of society or the Christian role in the world or God's action in the world or whatever? Because, as you recognize, the crucial thing about politics is that it is the authoritative shaping of public values through the use of the state, through the use of government. And what we are talking about here then is, in effect, using power in society to affect certain religiously motivated goals. Now, is that good? Is that Christian? How does that fit with the Christian understanding? Especially as you move from elements of what I would call sort of witness or testimony into actual attempts to shape public policy and use power to implement certain kinds of goals, does that in any sense contradict the way that religion ought to operate in society at large? Or is it a necessary task of Christians, at least at some level, to say, we want this element of our vision, at least, embodied in the kind of society in which we live, and we will work toward attaining that? That may involve cooperating with non-Christians on a particular issue or whatever, but we are willing to use the state in order to accomplish that. A particularly dramatic and troublesome example that might work for some people here would be, say, the civil rights question. That is, obviously, many Christian groups and movements, including Dr. King, organized, lobbied, acted, moved to get those laws passed so that we now have laws that say you may not discriminate against a black in the sale of housing, let's say, right? That is a public law, and people can be fined or thrown in jail for violating that, okay? Is that a Christian model of action? Is that legitimate way for Christianity to be realized in the public sphere? Because it's obviously using force, right? It's saying to the committed Ku Klux Klans person, no, you can't do it anymore. It's against the law, and the cops are going to show up and stop you from doing it. So now we have had Christianity, religion, used to implement a state public policy that involves at least coercion. So I think at least for some people there are problems and difficulties in that kind of arrangement. And I might just further distinguish, in the use of state influence and power, you can see different levels that I would call persuasion, coercion, and then actual violence. The attempt to use public policy to shape society, the coercive power of the law, and then finally, I guess, would be the example of violence, where a state would actually undertake, in effect, violent means to implement its understanding of Christian goals, right? You would say, we will use the Christian police force to implement this particular kind of vision of society at large, and is that legitimate or not? Well, there are all kinds of troublesome, I think, theological and philosophical questions that emerge from this, and there may be some other models, and I'm interested in some other models perhaps that could be developed, but these have been the major ones that have operated, and I think it's useful at least to have a sense of what that's like so that if you engage, if you feel called to engage in religiously motivated political action, you will have some sense of where that might go. Perhaps it's fair to say, of course, that most Christians don't do any of these. Most of them don't think of their religious life as involved in any very serious way in any attempt to alter the state for various reasons, theological, personal, political, or whatever. Most Christians, polls show, vote and act more on the basis of whether they are a middle-class homeowner in the South of Swedish descent than they do on the basis of any religious commitment. so that their goal of action is not one derived from any religious vision, but derived essentially from sociological or cultural or historical foundations, to the extent that they would engage in political action at all. Well, that's the end of my presentation. I'd be interested in some thoughts and comments. Yes, sir?
Where would you put the so-called moral majority into this?
Right here, really. Moral political movement designed to alter public policy on certain kinds of questions. Lots of people feared that it's this, but it really wasn't. I mean, even officially, they never said we're going to attempt a Christian takeover. They said we need to restore Christian values in America, and that means this, 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 and this. So they went out, organized people, sent people into caucuses, and so on and so on and so on, to attempt to implement certain religiously motivated political goals. Which, I should say, you know, all this within the American system is all perfectly legitimate. I mean, you can do all this stuff. Obviously, included in this, of course, at some point you can get into things of civil disobedience and so on. But even that can be religiously motivated attempt to shape public policy by violating a particular law focused on that policy.
One other question. Do you know if Bed for the World was the first to originate that type of a...
As far as I know, I mean, there were some comparable kinds of things. I think, for example, in the peace movement between the two world wars, there were some Christian groups that tried to organize similarly and had some impact. But I would be willing to guess that this is fairly unique, certainly in the post-World War II era, the model by which they operate.
The reason I ask that, I work for a large corporation who has a very similar model that they've developed in the last few years,
sure,
where they contact employees on a volunteer basis and inform them about issues that are beneficial or
sure,
maybe detrimental to the corporation, and encourage them to write letters to their representatives.
Sure, sure. And I mean, you know, every group in society knows how to operate this. I mean, from the private airline pilots to the banks to the, you know, because it works.
NRA,
everybody, you know, it works. And what's unique about Bread for the World, and I spent a little time in Washington for a while, is that, you know, they're among the few groups that appear not to, at least, to be self-interested in the ordinary sense. I mean, there aren't a lot of people advocating sending $100 million to Ethiopia. In the normal run of lobbies that a congressman meets in a day, he doesn't meet people saying, let's take $100 million of the budget from the Pentagon and send it off to Ethiopia. They get some attention just on that ground. But also it's because they really do their homework, and in the same way that a bank lobby or the NRA or whoever else does. And it would be interesting to ask why there aren't more of these. I mean, why aren't there Christian political movements similarly constructed? There are to a little extent, I think, on some questions. And I mentioned this impact and network thing. I think another thing that Bread for the World, I don't want to turn this into a propaganda for their operation, but I think it's interesting, is that they've stuck with a single issue for a long period of time, where, again, a lot of religious politics tends to sort of be what's in at the moment, and then it passes.
Hasn't there been discussion in Lutheran circles that some of the money that has been given for various world hunger causes to the church has been used for this kind of action, and that has caused disruption and discussion and more than discussion among...
Sure. I mean, I'm sure you could go out in parishes anyway. That was my distinction between religious social action, which almost, at least at some level, almost all Christian groups would endorse. Direct relief to the starving, wherever. But it's a different thing to say we're having our church leaders going in and attempting to affect politics. And some people, I think, that very word makes them very nervous. Okay, I think there are two elements, my understanding of the sanctuary movement, there would be two elements there. One would be a direct social action, taking in the refugee, right? That's a direct social action and could be undertaken for whatever motive, probably very charitable motive, We want to help people in trouble. However, the movement could also say, our goal is not simply to help these refugees, but to alter American policy on immigration and ultimately to overturn American policy in Central America. Which motives are operating, or how are they operating at different levels? To the extent those last two motives are operating, I would call it religious politics, and probably perfectly legitimate. That is, then you might be using the sanctuary idea as a way of publicizing and saying to the society at large, you're dead wrong on Central America. Alter, or you're dead wrong on refugee policy. Alter your refugee policy. So which motive is at work? Probably they're all at work simultaneously, in a sense. But at different times and levels, I could imagine different motives working in different ways. Sure, sure. And you're going to publicize the cause and say to the society at large, do you realize how your policy is generating refugees? So that's why you would act on that basis. Sure. I think that's right. And you can say the same thing about a good deal of Christian social service, wonderful as it might be, let's say. You know, you might be taking in, let's say, unwed mothers, and you might take in 100 unwed mothers, but maybe the public policy that is affecting the treatment of unwed mothers receiving certain kinds of benefits is what's generating that flow of people into your office in the first place. So at least at some point, some people pop up and say, well, let's get after the policy. That's the public policy is helping to cause this, so let's alter that. But that's a quite different kind of thing.
You mentioned that they just do lobbying. I think they do
research. Right. But do they have people out in the, you know, congressional districts that will phone and so on? Okay. Similar kind of BFW sort of thing. Yes, sir?
My question is, isn't it more, I mean, it just seems to be more effective to go to your own party and do that and put it in your platform than a lot of efforts churches make. That if Christians go to their own party and mobilize through that, I think you're going to have more power coming through with especially number four, church statements, I think, are laughed at. I just really think they're laughed at and an embarrassment to many people that, as you say, sure, they're put before them, the people, but, you know, they realize, I don't even have to read that because I know that most Lutherans are against that position. I mean, why is it how can it be an official position of the church if most people are against it, I, you know, that type of thing. I don't know what's your combating that. I mean, do churches think that the parties, we've given up on the party system, saying that can't work to go in through my own party and make a movement. We have to make a movement apart from the party, or?
Well, you know, you can have, distinguish between official church action. And any given group of people can obviously go in and form the Christians' Lobby for Anti-Nuclear War in the Republican Party of Iowa. And there's nothing to prevent that whatsoever. And the difference would be they would not say they're speaking for all groups. And actually, these official church statements usually don't say they are speaking for each and every single Methodist or whatever. What they say is, this is the official position of the Methodist Church. And churches actually are not democracies. Anyhow, most of them do not theologically understand themselves to be democracies. They understand themselves to be operating on other kinds of bases. But I think you're right in terms of political effectiveness. That is, once politicians learn that that reflects the Washington office of so-and-so, and sure, that's nice, and sometimes they make interesting points, and these are usually very smart people who do their homework, and maybe the people in the pews are laughing, but you know, there's a certain amount of intelligence and religious commitment that go into those statements. So they have some impact, but I think you're quite right. It would be far more effective to have, you know, 300,000 Lutherans marching into the Republican caucuses demanding issue X than it is to, this is my political judgment, than it is to have the Lutheran Office on Intergovernmental Affairs issue a statement on nuclear war. The trick is to organize those 300,000 Lutherans on any particular question.
Yeah. I guess I'm wondering, in response to what you just said, response to your question, if the church statements aren't thought out on sort of a theological level, and the average Lutheran is thinking more like a Swedish middle-class person, if you think about handguns, for example, you know, the church might make a statement that handguns are not good, but when you go out to the people, they don't think about the theological question, but rather, gosh, I better get a handgun to protect myself. I mean, that's pretty, I don't think any of us here would probably vote for that one. But there are apparently lots of people who think that carrying a handgun is something that is a good thing.
And your point, I take it, is that among the populace at large, public questions are not thought through on the basis of religion.
No, and maybe we should be doing something about that. Maybe we should be, at our congregational level, be thinking some of these issues through, rather than coming to decisions on them on the basis of our middle class values. We'd be thinking what are the real implications of these, and then maybe doing something about it. Because isn't it worth to just sit and make these decisions on the basis that they're being made right now?
And these are among the more important things you do, your role as a public citizen. And so if you at least would think that religion should have an important impact on your life, it is a curious question why that shouldn't be having an impact on your behavior. All the polls show it mostly doesn't. Although there is sort of what I'd call the social glue, and I'm going to talk about this a little more tomorrow, specifically in relation to Lutheranism. That is, many groups sort of act as tribes. You know, Southern Baptists will kind of tend to vote for certain people primarily because they pick up certain signals on certain kinds of questions and so on. But I think you're quite right that it's not necessarily on the basis of theology or religious motive per se.
Well, another issue that comes to my mind, and maybe this is more Canadian than it is American, but the issue of whether there should be capital punishment. And I think a lot of churches would think that too and come out with a statement that no, there shouldn't be capital punishment. But many, many people in the pews would say, oh yes, should hang them all.
So these are right here. The house is on me. Can I give you? Yes. I'll buy them from you.
What about that question I asked at the end? Does this whole idea of using government, in effect, as a way of implementing Christian values in society cause discomfort, or is that a necessary part of any kind of society that Christian values are going to be comfortable in?
I'm sure you have a range of views on that in the church from those who feel that, you know, it should be our number one objective to influence policy through the government and use the federal system or whatever power to implement those policies, to the people who say religion should have no impact on the government because the government is only evil. And I think we need to realize that if we're influencing policy as a church, say motivated by scripture, for example, that we don't in some way make that system holy, that we're changing. You know, that all of a sudden, no, it's going to make these policies changes, and now it's going to be an arm of the church, you know. But we're dealing, you know, the church itself, the earthly church itself is an imperfect system. And we need to remember that, and then we got to remember that our system, our government system is imperfect, you know. And so we always have to deal, I think, with that reality. That sure, we can work for change, we can work for better, but, you know, things are always going to be deteriorating. That's the nature of our world. Not to accept that in a sense of hopelessness, certainly, but
Mel?
Yeah.
Is there a way of thinking about your categories along another dimension that would have to do with the level of politics you're talking about? I'm thinking an awful lot of these categories and the examples you've given have all been at the national level.
Yes.
And it seems to me often that that the church is a more visible and effective presence the more local one's realm of activity is.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in fact, there's something about the church as a communion, as a community, as a community building block, I'm thinking about neighborhoods and cities, for example, which is decidedly local in its character. And therefore, the kind of public activity which is produced by a church sometimes seems to me to be at its most effective at a level which you haven't mostly touched on.
Right. Yeah, I think to the extent that you get down to face-to-face communities and smaller political institutions, these processes become less abstract and formal law, for example, and more informal matters of values, say, within a community or whatever. And a good deal, obviously, of what I would call political value shaping can go on in communities by churches, even without invoking the formal institutions of law, government, state, police, and so on. I think that's quite right. So then you get into the question of the relative power of those relative sectors and how those interact, and whether policies that a community might battle for might really be being shaped from higher levels of, say, federal funding or something. So then they're up against that all the time. But I think that's perfectly legitimate. And it seems to me, at the local level, the tension between religious politics and religious social action is also less. That is, you can go out and say, we are going to work to improve our neighborhood, and that can have a kind of social action, but also a quasi-political dimension that doesn't exactly involve the matter of public policy from the top down.
Although it can still be really controversial.
Sure. And, of course, I haven't said in here, obviously, what you get into is different religious communities operating with different kinds of values and political goals. Bang. That can be a real problem then. Because again, that's one of the difficulties of this whole approach, some people would say, is that you are bringing the transcendent to the mundane. And to the extent that we start invoking our ultimate commitments in the realm of our limited commitments, we're raising the stakes. And potentially, at least, that the danger is that you arrive at situations where people can't cooperate because their transcendent visions are at odds. Now, our society appears to have astounding capacities to sort of fuzz all that over and work around it. But it's always a potential danger. And the kind of arguments you use in public may be very different from what you would use in a religious community, right? I mean, it doesn't make much sense if you get up in a city council to say, well, we need to implement better housing for the poor because Jesus told us to care for the poor. I don't think this isn't going to carry with the Jewish, alderman there. It's not. He might listen, but it's not going to sway his vote. You have to say a public goal. You have to say, at the very least, justice for society. Our society demands justice. That's why we will do it, or ought to do it. That's a different kind of goal. But at least you can recognize that you get into some sticky wickets here, I think. And it takes real skill to understand motive and audience in a given situation or context, I think.
When you mentioned the idea of Christian groups cooperating with other secular groups, I thought of a thing that was voted on or came out of the church during the bicentennial called the Manifesto for the Third Century. I don't know if you remember that. But one of the things that they talked about is that the American Lutheran Church looks towards the 300 years of the United States was we should cooperate with any group that is working towards the same goal as we are. Mm-hmm. And I remember, back then there was a lot of discussion about that.
Yeah, cooperating with other groups that don't share your motives. Yes?
I don't know if it came up before I was able to get here, but on the flip side, it was interesting to see that an organization that had been in place for some time, Lutheran World Relief, and well-run, not corrupt, by standards
hopeful, you know, that some of those do exist, like give it the benefit, that when, because it was in place and functioning well, that when a need came, it was the organization that was picked to really be used for a larger scale.
Sure.
So I think it's interesting if we really act out on where we are, you know, it is recognized.
Sure, that's certainly, you have official church agencies and so on that do a great deal of good, and often governments will turn to churches because they know that they have skill in certain kinds of areas, and that perhaps is working the reverse situation. Yes, sir.
It occurs to me that the models are based on some commitment to an altruistic mode or ideal. And that's fine as long as my self-interest doesn't come in conflict. I can give allegiance to any kind of movement as long as my self-interest is consistent. But the moment my self-interest is in conflict, my commitment is a little soft. And I wonder if commitments to any kind of model of political action don't break down when the individual suddenly realizes that his self-interest is no longer involved or is being challenged by that. And so no particular movement's going to get very far unless it takes the person's self-interest along with it.
Well, you're quite right. First of all, I deliberately didn't say the character of the motive behind these and sort of listed all kinds of them to avoid that. But presumably, most people would say that something defined as Christian social action should somehow involve something other than what's in it for us. Although you might get into that. But then I think the question you raise is a very good one. That is, what happens when the Christian homeowner comes up against the issue of, shall we have open housing laws, and will that cause my house to drop $10,000 in value? There you are. And you know, there's the issue. And how do you sort that through? And I'm not sure. Part of, I guess, my little underlying emphasis here is that I think there needs to be, as someone said over here, more of this sort of among the lay folks themselves generating this within religious communities, because I think that's where you can talk frankly about those kinds of things. And part of my perception of how churches work is that there's a kind of piety that comes from on high, and we all sit and listen to it, and it rolls over us, and as you say, somebody said, the church statement makes statements and so on, but who really cares? Whereas I think groups of Christian people acting on their motives and having to wrestle through exactly those questions, then that raises it all very directly. And again, I mentioned the case of Bread for the World. Again, one of the things I think they do very well is, for example, they have a lot of farmers. They'll bring a lot of farmers right into the conversation about our overseas food policies. And you'll get, you know, farmers sitting there, and they're talking about, what's my profit margin going to be next fall if sales to Pakistan drop, you know, whatever. And that puts it on a more... But they're also wrestling then with the nature of their Christianity. What's my Christianity got to do with my role as a farmer who has to realize, and I think that's very important. One more question? Yes?
Well, just a comment in addressing your question. It seems to me that for Lutherans, and maybe this is where you go to Mark, that theologically we wouldn't have a problem addressing a political system if we take traditional Lutheran theology in the two realms. I mean, there is the realm of Caesar, Luther would have said, and Caesar's role is to have justice and order in society, and we're to be influencing that and make sure that happens.
Okay.
It seems to me that...
Good lead-in for the session tomorrow. I'll pick up and play with that, and I hope we can do some more of that. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.